The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here at the Free Library, and I'm very pleased to welcome our guests this evening. A few months ago, the most recent version of one of the best-selling books of all times was released. While the book consistently tops the Amazon charts, particularly when a new edition is released or when the school year begins, you won't find it listed on the New York Times bestseller list, despite its popularity. It's not The Bible, Mein Kampf, Gone with the Wind, or 50 Shades of Grey, though you might argue that it has many more shades of grey than 50. It is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. Like any textbook, it comes with the veneer of truth. Like any textbook, it has an agenda and a point of view. Unlike most textbooks, it is worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the medical and insurance establishments. And unlike any textbook, the words in this book have a direct impact on our self-perception, the way we speak, and the water we drink. Not everyone is pleased with the agenda and point of view of the most recent DSM, least of all our guest this evening, Dr. Gary Greenberg, the author of the Book of Woe, the DSM, and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Gary Greenberg is a practicing psychotherapist, the author of 4 books, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones, as well as a contributing editor for Harper's. He is also the recipient of the Eric Erickson Award for Mental Health Reporting. Tonight, he will be in conversation with Julia Klein, a culture reporter and contributing editor at Columbia Journalism Review. Please join me in welcoming Gary Greenberg and Julia Klein.
Well, thank you all for coming out.
That was my line.
Well, you could say it. Go ahead. No, say it.
Thank you all for coming. It's a good crowd.
I wanted to, before we start, just also thank Julia. Julia made the grievous error of writing a positive review of my book in the Chicago Tribune. And then she compounded the felony by confessing to living in Philadelphia. And I read this a couple of weeks ago, and on this book tour, what I've been doing is impressing people into service to get them to interview me and actually take all the onus off of me. So I contacted Julia and hornswoggled her into taking the onus off of me. And so now go ahead and do that.
Okay, fair enough. So in talking to friends about this event, I've described you as a critic of psychiatric diagnosis. Is that correct as a shorthand?
I'd say that's an understatement.
So can you expand on that for us?
Sure. So here's my beef. You know, people ask me, what's your beef anyway? My beef is that it's very personal. It's because I'm a therapist. I'm getting a little feedback up here. I don't know if anything can be done about that, but as a psychotherapist, I discovered early on that one of my jobs was to diagnose people. That struck me as a little strange, but what really struck me as strange was the list of diagnoses that I had to work with, which came from this book called the DSM, which of course studied in my abnormal psychology classes and all. And what really bothered me about it was that nobody seemed to think that this book was any good. It's like everybody who I worked with, psychiatrists included, they just sort of wanted to say, well, you know, don't pay any attention to it. Just go through the motions and write down the codes that are in the book and be done with it. And for a while, I thought that was okay to do. But then it really began to bother me because it's like, well, wait a minute. Here I am. I'm supposed to be in these relationships with people where what they're paying me for is honesty, both mine and also to encourage theirs. And here we are starting our relationship this way. I'm going to read something from my book to answer that question, if that's all right.
Sure.
See, the thing is, when you get somebody to interview you, they also get to tell you sort of what you can do. So what happens with the DSM is that a therapist is, if you want to get insurance payments, you're required to render a diagnosis. And you work with the DSM, which is the official name is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, to find a diagnosis that matches the person that you're working with. And what every therapist does is come up with a list of diagnoses that they use over and over again. And after a while, even though you spend $100 on the book, you don't use it anymore because you got it down by heart. At the top of my favorites list is 309.28, which stands for adjustment disorder with mixed anxiety and depressed mood. Here's how it's defined in the fourth edition of the DSM. A, the development of emotional or behavioral symptoms in response to an identifiable stressor occurring within 3 months of the onset of the stressor. B, these symptoms or behaviors are clinically significant as evidenced by either of the following. One, marked distress that is in excess of what would be expected from exposure to the stressor. Two, significant impairment in social or occupational or academic functioning. It goes on. I won't bore you with the rest of it. You get the idea. And I also think you can see why 309.28 is popular with clinicians and why insurance companies' claims examiners probably see it all the time. It sounds innocuous, which makes it go down easy with patients. If, as I do, you tell them which mental illness you are now adding to their medical dossier, and with employers or insurers or others who might have occasion to scrutinize a patient's medical history and be put off by a more serious-sounding diagnosis. But adjustment disorder has a special place in my own heart because it was my first diagnosis, or at least the first one I knew about. I got it sometime in the early 1980s when I was in my early 20s and the DSM was in its third edition. I don't remember why I wanted to be in therapy or very much of what I talked about with my therapist. I do remember that my father was paying for it. He was probably hoping I would discover that my self-chosen circumstances, living alone in a cabin in the woods without the modern conveniences, were a symptom of something that could be fixed. What I was being treated for, however, was not back to the land disorder or why don't you grow up already disorder. But rather, as I discovered one day when I glanced down at my statement on the receptionist's desk, adjustment disorder. I guess the tag seemed about right. I definitely wasn't adjusting. And if it occurred to me that by calling my lifestyle an illness, my therapist had passed judgment on exactly where the problem resided, I didn't think much of it at the time. But I do remember that I noticed, for the first time, that I'd been going to these weekly appointments in a doctor's office. It happened to be in a building adjacent to the office of my childhood pediatrician, but it did not smell like alcohol or have a white, shrewd woman bustling about, nor did its business seem a bit related to the shots and probes I'd suffered next door. So the discord really stood out. But still, the fact of that diagnosis, right there in black and white, was undeniable. I was a mental patient. I was eventually cured of my maladjustment, not by therapy, but by a family coup that resulted in my grandfather's being relieved of a farm he'd inherited from his mother. That happened to be the land on which I built my home, and so I was evicted, my cabin eventually bulldozed, and the land converted to McMansions, and it became necessary for me to earn a living. Of the many adjustments I have had to make, diagnosing people in order to secure an income was one of the strangest. Not only because the DSM's label seemed so insufficient, its criteria so deracinated, the whole procedure so banal in comparison with the rich and disturbing and ultimately inexhaustible conversation that was occurring in my office, but also, and much more important, because of the bad faith involved. I didn't mind colluding with my patients against the insurance companies. Sometimes I actually enjoyed the thought. I brought them in on the scam, explaining exactly what diagnosis I was giving them, sometimes even taking out the book and reading the criteria and occasionally offering them a choice. But the fact that we were sharing the lie didn't make our business any less dishonest. I know therapists who diagnose everyone with adjustment disorder, unless the insurance company limits benefits for its treatment on the grounds that it isn't enough of an illness to warrant much treatment, at which point the patient often contracts a sudden case of something much worse, like major depressive disorder. Myself, I prefer to mix things up a little, but mostly I prefer not to do business with insurance companies, so I often don't have to bother with such dilemmas. Of course, that means I get paid less money, since not everyone can afford my rates without a little help from their friends at Aetna. So I end up giving people a break in return for steering clear of the whole unsavory business. Over the 30 years I've been in practice, I probably left a couple $1 million on the table by avoiding the DSM. It's an expensive habit, but I think of it as buying my way out of bad faith. And it's not just my rank-and-file colleagues and I who think of the DSM as if it were a colonoscopy, a necessary evil, something to be endured and quickly forgotten, and surely not to be taken seriously unless you have to. I once asked psychiatrist and former president of the APA, Paul Fink, to tell me how the DSM was helpful in his family practice, in his daily practice. "I have a patient that I've been seeing for 2 months," he told me. And my secretary said, "What's the diagnosis?" I thought a lot about it because I hadn't really formulated it. And then I began to think, what are her symptoms? What does she do? How does she behave? I diagnosed her with obsessive compulsive disorder. "Did this change the way you treated her?" I asked. "No." "So what was its value, would you say?" "I got paid." It is at least ironic that a profession once dedicated to the pursuit of psychological truth is now dependent on this kind of dishonesty for its survival. But I suppose that any system guided by the invisible hand, financial markets no more than healthcare financing, is bound to be gamed, and the DSM, whatever its flaws, has proved to be a superb playbook.
Thank you. Just to follow through on that, what exactly is wrong with the DSM as a concept, and what makes the DSM-5 worse, if it is worse, than its predecessors?
So the idea of developing a common language so that clinicians, when they're talking to each other, know what they're talking about is not a bad idea. Although I tend to think that the English language can be used with sufficient clarity in a way that works. I think we can have conversations. But, you know, the reality is there isn't always time for conversations. And some of the problems that we're dealing with are very serious and need to be attended to quickly. So the idea of having a shorthand is a good one. The problem with this particular shorthand is that it relies on medical rhetoric, on a scientific rhetoric, as if we knew that these illnesses exist in nature in the same way that cancer and diabetes exist, which psychiatric illnesses don't. And I'm not saying anything controversial there. No psychiatrist, even the most mainstream DSM-supporting psychiatrist, will tell you that these disorders exist in that way. So you have a disconnect between, on the one hand, the rhetoric, and on the other hand, the reality. And that's a problem at many levels, not the least of which is that a whole apparatus, the DSM underlies the research, it underlies the drug development, it underlies educational services, it underlies clinical services, it underlies a huge sector of the healthcare economy, as well as a part of the legal economy. So you have this disconnect, you have this idea that the scientific rhetoric is legitimizing the expenditure of these resources, and it gets really wacky. For instance, the top psychiatrist in this country, the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, told me, schizophrenia, the problem with the DSM is it encourages psychiatrists to think that schizophrenia exists. What happens is that this language, this rhetoric, becomes a reality. It gets what they call reified. And then suddenly all the research and all the treatment is devoted to diseases that everybody knows don't exist. It's like Alice in Wonderland. So that's the problem. I hope that's clear, that really is a problem. As far as the DSM-5 making it worse, there may be some ways in which the DSM-5 makes it worse. There may be some ways in which it makes it better. It probably is going to cancel each other out as long as you're not one of the people who's either disadvantaged or advantaged by it, in which case you don't really care that it all comes out in the wash. People who had Asperger's diagnoses who lose them, because that's one of the changes in the DSM-5 is to eliminate Asperger's, will be disadvantaged. On the other hand, people whose hoarding disorders were previously not recognized may be advantaged. So I don't think the DSM-5 is going to make it any worse because it's the same problem.
Another big critic of the DSM-5 has been Alan Francis, who chaired the DSM-4 task force, and he's written his own book, Saving Normal. What are your areas of agreement with Francis, and where do you part company with him?
Well, let's see. My areas of agreement with Francis are, Al Francis is an extremely honest man. He's a remarkable man, really. He's made his living as a psychiatrist. He became became, in the words of the New York Times, America's most powerful psychiatrist by editing the DSM-IV. Now, Alan saw what was going on with the DSM-5 and decided that the people who were doing it were insufficiently attentive to how fragile of the diagnostic system it was. The reason it was fragile is what I was just talking about, the fact that it's all rhetoric and no reality. From Al's point of view, what that means is that you have to be very careful with it. It's like his baby. And he saw them messing with his baby. And I don't mean that in an egotistical way. He really believes that this book is for everybody's good. And that they were insufficiently attentive to just how fragile it is when you create what amount to fictions, and then you open it up to controversy. Because then what happens is the public loses belief. And everybody knows, or should know, that the placebo effect is really important in all of medicine and certainly in psychiatry. And the placebo effect hinges on believing in your doctor. So if there's this huge public scuffle about whether or not Asperger's disorder exists or whether or not grief is the same thing as depression or all these other controversies, what happens is you lose faith. Psychiatry loses credibility. It loses the confidence of his patients. And Al and I agree that that's the problem. Where we disagree is he thinks that psychiatry deserves our confidence, and I'm not so sure.
There's some critics of the manual, and I think you've already mentioned him in passing, Tom Inselm of the National Institute of Mental Health, who see the goal of psychiatry as to find biological markers for mental illness. We haven't done that yet, but what if it were possible? Would you see that as a good thing?
I find the fact that this is the direction things are going is one of the reasons that things that makes me grateful for mortality. Because by the time they figure this out, I will be gone. And I mean that sort of funny, but as funny as my death could be. But go ahead, laugh at the fact that I'm going to die. I believe that what happens is that whether it's neuroscience or the age of reason, the Enlightenment, these huge epochal shifts in our understanding of what being human is about, when they happen, they leave people behind. So I think what's going to happen here, if they're successful, and by the way, what they want to do at the National Institute of Mental Health is understand the basic circuitry of our problems. And if they succeed in elucidating the neurochemistry of our experience and our consciousness, this will change how we think of ourselves. I don't think it will change how we think of ourselves for the better, but on the other hand, in 500 years of humanism, which is the epoch we're living in now, it's not exactly been a utopia. So
until that happens, may not happen for a long time, don't we need some way of standardizing diagnosis, both for the sake of treatment and for the sake of our health insurance system? And so what are the alternatives?
I'm not sure. I mean, We need it for the sake of treatment because most people need their insurance to pay for treatment.
Right.
But that's a circle, and it's a pernicious circle.
Right.
But do we need these diagnoses? I'm not sure. I mean, psychiatrists, good psychiatrists, will tell you that they treat symptoms. And there's nothing wrong with that. They treat hallucinations. They treat delusions. They treat moods. They treat symptoms, not disorders. A better language of symptoms might also do the trick without creating these categories that don't exist. The problem with that is that we live in a world where we think that unless you know the essence of the thing, it's not enough to know the symptom. It's not enough to know that you have a headache or you have a chest pain or something like that. You've got to know the underlying disease. Well, that's true in terms of medicine, but that model may not really be able to be translated to the mind. I still haven't seen the evidence that it is.
But don't you think there's some value, if only in terms of behavioral insight, in recognizing that certain clusters of symptoms tend to occur together and seem to make up discrete, discernible maladies? And isn't it good to try to find what those are, even if we haven't gotten it right yet?
Well, from an anthropological point of view, it's really interesting. Yes. And
not from a medical point of view.
Well, I think it's hard to demonstrate the value of them from a medical point of view. I mean, I could be wrong, and I don't mean to be glib, but I don't think we've seen all that much value returned to us for living under the regime of the DSM. I mean, let's think about antidepressants for a moment. 11% of the American people are on antidepressants. Now, that would indicate that they're all being treated for depression, but they're not. Three-quarters of the prescriptions written for antidepressants are written in the absence of a diagnosis. So there's this huge disconnect between diagnosis and treatment. And that's just one example of them. So I think the burden should be on psychiatry to demonstrate that kind of value. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I haven't studied it. But it is really interesting that symptoms cluster together. That's true. What that means, I mean, the fact that, for instance, lack of appetite couples or groups together with low mood, you know, depressed mood, groups together with sleep disorders. I mean, maybe it all seems sort of intuitive, but that's really interesting. I'm just not sure that it's interesting in the same way that, sore throat and fever group together for strep throat is interesting.
Maybe more interesting.
I think it is decidedly more interesting, but from an anthropological point of view.
Or an evolutionary perspective?
Maybe. I mean,
You're not an evolutionary psychologist.
Don't get me started in evolution.
Okay. Is one of your...
I'll come off like a creationist, so...
Is one of your great concerns the rush to treat all these maladies, real or imagined, with drugs that make profits for big companies? Is that one of the central animating forces?
It's a terrible problem, and I would say that it's always underneath. Anybody that thinks critically about psychiatry has to worry about this. You know, one of the things that the DSM has done, not on purpose, this is not why they wrote it, but one of the things that it's done is it's legitimized a lot of this, the proliferation of psychiatric drugs. If a doctor tells you you have a chemical imbalance and you need Prozac or some other brand name to rectify it, that's a whole lot more powerful than saying to you, I know about this drug called Prozac, and I see that you're having trouble sleeping and you're depressed, and people that feel that way tend to do better, and this drug will probably make you feel better. Those are two different kinds of statements, and the first one is enabled by the DSM. And so that disease language does underlie, I think, a great deal, the proliferation of mental disorders. You see this especially with children. The number of children on powerful psychiatric drugs in this country that have not been tested on children, whose long-term effects are not understood, whose main effects aren't understood, and nobody really knows why these drugs do what they do, it's absolutely astonishing. And I would tell you that in 1939, the man who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine was the guy who invented the lobotomy. That's a really important piece of history to know. 50 years from now, what is that, 73 years from now, how is this going to look? They're going to look back on this and say, what did you do to your children? So why do parents agree? Well, because they're desperate, because their children are really troubled, because the doctor tells them your child has bipolar disorder. I don't think you're going to take antipsychotic drugs in the absence of a diagnosis. I mean, I don't think so.
I mean, biological psychiatry has become very powerful, as we all know. You've noted that the DSMs are profit centers for the American Psychiatric Association. Is part of what's going on, I mean, obviously this is a philosophical question and so on, but is part of what's going on here a turf battle between psychiatrists and the rest of the mental health industry?
At some level? Well, I don't think so. Not as much as you might think. I mean, tell me more. What would that turf war?
Well, I mean, therapists treat with talk therapy, but insurers are mostly reimbursing for drugs. Mm-hmm. And because of that, that's another great pressure towards medicating. And
yeah, I haven't had that experience. I mean, I've been practiced for 30 years, and I've never felt that particular kind of turf battle. What I do see is that people are increasingly adopting this idea that they are an assortment of brain chemicals and that their troubles are chemical events, which is true at a certain level. I mean, without your brain, nothing would happen, right? Thank God every day for your brain chemicals, because there they are. But what has happened is that people have come increasingly to think of themselves, their troubles, as the result of chemical imbalances, which are mythical. I mean, nobody's ever proved yet. What is the chemical imbalance that Prozac treats? A serotonin deficiency? Nobody knows that. I mean, that was a theory for a while, but it's been pretty roundly, disproved, and it's not anywhere near what they're looking at now. So I think that the problem there isn't so much a turf war as it is a mythology that has pervaded the culture. And when people come to my office, sometimes they have to be talked to about that mythology.
Well, you talk about the empire of psychiatry being built on air, and now you've taken us to your office. So a lot of people have asked me, well, if he's so skeptical about psychiatry, how can he be a practicing psychotherapist? So the question is, how do you treat patients? What are your approaches, biases?
Yeah, well, therapy is a placebo treatment. And placebo is not a bad thing. I mean, placebo, we think of it as this kind of fake, sham, lie, but it isn't really. A placebo treatment is just the result of there's a great book by Jerome Frank, Persuasion and Healing. A placebo treatment is just a testimony to the power of human relationships. So what do I do in my practice? I try to develop relationships with people where they can be honest with themselves and me, and from that, usually, if it works, learn something about themselves and usually change what they're doing in a way that makes their life better.
But there's no ideological framework. You don't call yourself an ex-therapist or...
No. No, should I?
I don't know, but is there a value added to seeing you as opposed to talking to a very good, empathetic friend?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, because
you get a better placebo effect because you're being...
Because there's no question about it. When they look back at what we did to our children, they're also going to look back at this idea that you snuck into an office where nobody could hear what you were doing, and for an hour at a time, to be honest. So I'd be the first person to tell you that the only reason I have a job is because there are certain deep problems in our culture that make honesty sort of at a premium. And the fact that I can charge money for that is probably a scandal from some point of view. I'll cop to that.
Okay. You mentioned the adjustment.
But I won't give the money back.
Okay. You mentioned the adjustment disorder in this book. In a previous book of yours, Manufacturing Depression, you talk very candidly about your own struggles with depression and your participation in a clinical drug trial. How do you think your own personal experience has influenced your approach to therapy and to the DSM?
Man, if I'd known you were going to ask such personal questions.
Put it in the book.
So it's true. It's true. But, writing is a whole different thing. Well, I think I've already talked about one of the ways, which is that, the whole idea of being in this compromised position. But the other way that it affects me is that I know from my experience, I had in another book I wrote about how I went to attended a clinical trial. I tried to get into a clinical trial for what was called at the time minor depression, which I just assumed it was the Bush years. I assumed everybody had it. And I ended up taking, the tests and all that, and it turned out I had major depression, which came as a revelation to me. But the weird thing was that even though I've been skeptical about this stuff for 30 years, that diagnosis really worked on me. Worked in the sense like an earworm works on you. It messed with my way of thinking and understanding myself. The idea that in some scientific discourse, I had a disease. So I know how powerful these pronouncements can be, whether they're pronouncements of diagnoses or a pronouncement to somebody, the reason you're like that is because this is the way your mother treated you. When these things come from a person in authority, they're very powerful. And so I think one of the things that is done, I wouldn't exactly say it's made me humble, because unfortunately that isn't one of my best characteristics, but... It has made me really aware of and careful with the power and that these professions have.
And one more thing, and then we'll open it up for questions. There, just to double back a little bit, there are a couple of specific areas that you cover in the book that were wrangled over in the DSM that I think are of interest to a lot of people. One is people trying to figure out the difference between depression and grief or bereavement, and also the loss of Asperger's syndrome as a separate diagnosis. Can you talk just a little more about the significance or impact of those?
Yeah, let me talk about the grief thing because it's really interesting.
Really interesting.
So here's what happened. Back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, psychiatry had a huge crisis. It was like on the brink of extinction. The insurance companies and the government had lost faith in psychiatry because psychiatrists couldn't agree. They didn't have the common language yet. Well, part of the deal in making up this common language that emerged in the third edition of the DSM in 1980 was that there was going to be no more talk about where mental disorders came from. They felt that where they'd gone wrong, especially in a case of homosexuality, which, as you all know, was a mental disorder until 1973, where had they gone wrong? They'd gone wrong by saying not that people who had sex with other people were inherently mentally ill, but they were mentally ill because that was an example, that was a symptom of an intrapsychic conflict. The idea being that if you could establish the cause of the behavior and say that cause was neurotic, therefore the thing was sick. So they said, well, we won't let that happen again. We'll stop talking about causes. We'll just talk about symptoms. And so as I read you this section from the adjustment disorder from the DSM, it's just a collection of lists of symptoms. I shouldn't say just. It's a list of symptoms carefully observed. And in the case of depression, no attempt to differentiate between depressions that come on for a reason or depressions that just seem to come out of nowhere. Well, the problem here is that when people lose a loved one, they often qualify for the diagnosis of major depression. And the people who made up the diagnosis knew that because they did the research that showed it. So they had this terrible problem. Either we call people who are grieving mentally ill, or we have to do something alluding to the causes of mental disorder. So they decided to create an exception. They carved out an exclusion in the DSM called the bereavement exclusion, saying that if you have all the symptoms of depression but you were within 2 months of a bereavement, you don't have depression. Every other disorder in the book you have if you have the criteria and they're clinically significant. This one you don't. So I can tell because people are laughing. On the face of it, that's ridiculous. So, and what happened was people who were critics of the DSM, not me, but other critics of the DSM, used that to sort of drive a wedge into to the DSM. They did research and they showed, hey, there's no difference between bereavement and unemployment and divorce and foreclosure and any other catastrophe. People who suffer who have those losses, they show up as depressed. So why only bereavement? So the DSM-5 committee was faced with a choice. Either they expand the range of the exclusions and go back to the old days where it did matter whether your depression came from somewhere or didn't, or get rid of the bereavement exclusion and just say any depression is illness. Well, you can guess which one they did. They eliminated the bereavement exclusion. So now, according to the DSM, if you come into my office and, you know, 2 weeks after you've lost your partner, and you have the symptoms of depression, I can diagnose you. The way this works is that I'm no longer forbidden to diagnose you. I still don't have to. It's important to point this out. The DSM is not compulsory, which is good in a case like this, but it also means that clinicians are free to totally ignore it.
There's also the footnote.
There's a footnote now.
There's a footnote.
In the new DSM-5.
A very interesting footnote.
Yeah, have you read it?
Yes.
Oh, well.
You want me to explain it?
I haven't seen it.
Well, you haven't seen it? Mm-hmm. It attempts to differentiate between grief and depression and to say that if your feelings of emptiness and loss are focused on the loved one, then it's probably grief. But if you're basically just thinking about yourself, it's depression.
Are you sure that's in the footnote?
I'm sure. It's a shorter or a summary way of saying it, but yeah.
Okay.
It's a very interesting footnote.
Yeah, they're trying to help the clinician sort of be nuanced, which is a good thing.
Right.
The interesting part of it is that it still creates the opportunity to call a bereaved person depressed, sick. And what that does is it creates an opportunity for the drug companies to get a diagnosis, an indication for bereavement-related depression. And, of course, there do happen to be clinical trials for just that. So that you will, and this is a way of extending your patent protection, right? If you have an indication, if only one antidepressant is approved for bereavement-related depression, then presumably that's the one that you're going to get prescribed.
Okay. We're going to open it up for questions. I'm assuming there are a lot of questions, and you're supposed to wait for the microphone. And okay, this man over here was very quick.
Thank you, Dr. Greenberg. Would you comment, if you can, briefly on how feeling cared for and sharing the pain promotes neuroplasticity and neurogenesis, a la Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and how that helps repair the trauma of earlier life?
Well, the comment I would make about that, Doidge's book is one of the best neuroscience books out there. What's it called? The Brain That Changes Itself? Changes Itself, yeah. He's a really, really good writer, and he doesn't overstate the case as most neuroscientists do, at least in my opinion. But what I want to say about that is that when we find out that a close healing relationship, you know, increases neurogenesis, that is the production of new brain cells, and affects brain plasticity, that sounds really cool. And it probably is really cool. But it's really, I always want to say, but exactly what have you changed about my understanding of that phenomenon? What have you added to it? Really what you're saying to me is the thing that we already know is happening has a neural component. Well, that's good to know, but I'm not sure it adds very much to know it. Except if you happen to be like a neuroscience person, in which case it's really interesting. But too often we don't believe these things are real until somebody shows us the MRI. Oh, hey, look, we found empathy in the MRI. We didn't just make that stuff up.
Other questions? Yes, that man right over there. Wait for the microphone.
A quick personal anecdote and then a serious question. In the early 60s, psychologists in New York State were forbidden to diagnose, which required that we became very skilled writers in being able to describe what was going on. For myself, I once then took a Rorschach course, and the teacher presented us with a list of responses, and we had to come up with a diagnosis. I failed. And then spent at least 6 months studying very hard to be able to make diagnoses. I then felt definitely inferior to psychiatrists who could make diagnoses based upon their own interviewing. And I did not feel like a whole therapist, and I mean that seriously, until I was entered into an analytic institute, which also included psychiatrists, and I was treated like a peer. And then really, when the homosexual diagnosis adventure happened, I said, no, you know, this is all silly. So that really freed me. But I still write well. and I took part in a drug study. It was 67 or 66, I don't remember. It was better than yours. Mine was LSD in Downstate Medical Center.
I have taken part in some of those studies. However, they weren't as well supervised as yours.
the serious question is, I just happened to see Hannah Arendt, the movie, which was not a very good movie, but it was about a very important matter historically. And her definition of what Eichmann's problem was in terms of not being able to think or feel sounded very much like a personality disorder. And as I understand it, because I haven't looked at the new DSM volumes, personality disorders have basically been eliminated. How does that, and How does that get in the way or help us to treat moral issues as different from mental illness issues?
So there's a lot in that question that so for those of you who don't know the secret handshake yet, personality disorders are a kind of, they're a whole different breed of psychiatric diagnosis. They have to do with the question of how people actually function in the world, as opposed to, you know, an anxiety disorder or a depressive disorder. And they were not eliminated. There was an attempt to eliminate about half of them. There are 10 personality disorders in the DSM. There was an attempt to eliminate them. It caused a mutiny. It's in my book. You can read it after you buy it. It's for sale here. But it's really important to say that the personality disorders are the final vestige of Freudian psychology in the DSM. The idea that human beings are, that the mind is something that goes beyond the brain, and that the mind is something unto itself, it exists in the DSM in the form of personality disorders. As to how you connect that with our moral lives, well, I think if you don't think of the mind as something that exceeds the brain, you've got all sorts of trouble, morally speaking, which is goes back to my earlier comment about mortality.
Questions? Yes.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, what problems do you see with trying to use evolution to understand mental
disorders? I should not have
said
anything.
Are you familiar with any of the books of Steven Pinker?
Sure.
How the Mind Works? What do you think of him and...
Well, without getting into into that, let me just say that the problem with evolutionary psychology is that how do we know any of that? We can speculate, and a lot of it's really interesting. But it's another really interesting mythology. We have 5,000 years of recorded history. We got maybe, what do those cave paintings go back now? Maybe 25 or 30,000 years? Huh? 35,000 years. Do I hear 40?
I think it depends which cave.
And maybe 100 and somebody's going to correct me on this one too. 125, 150,000 years of human beings. The vast majority of our sojourn on Earth is completely unknowable. Well, 98% unknowable. We can tell a few things by the gnaw marks on people's bones. So the problem with evolutionary explanations is that they're sort of the classic unverifiable statement. They're no more verifiable than Freudian psychology. So that's my complaint.
Is there a microphone? Quick follow-up, and then we'll let somebody else ask.
In Pinker's books, he goes into a lot of detail about the predictions that we've made with certain theories in evolutionary psychology, and there is experimental evidence that backs up the predictions that we make with the theories. One thing that pops into my head immediately is studies on things like morning sickness in pregnant women and postpartum depression. These people fall into the same kind of patterns that you would expect to find from an evolutionist point of view. I don't want to go into the details right now, but it does a good job at explaining why certain symptoms of mental illness can cluster together so often.
There's no question that there's a close connection between genetics and personalities. There's no question about that, or at least families and personalities. So there may be something to it. But what I would point out is that evolution is looking at us through the lens of natural selection is a way of looking for a pattern. And if we had evolved from cats, we wouldn't be doing that. So I'll go with evolutionary psychology that far.
Questions? The woman right there. I actually have three questions, if I may. One of them is really short. First,
one more, and we could have a seder.
Just one. I was surprised. One question per person, because there's a lot of people.
I was surprised to hear you say that schizophrenia doesn't exist. Well, I'll say the three, and he could choose which one to answer. The schizophrenia doesn't exist, and I'm wondering what you call that occurrence that is commonly referred to as schizophrenia. And I don't know if you prescribe medications for your patients. And the last one is, I was wondering if you have any insight as to why Asperger's was removed from the DSM and who that helps. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, that's easy. No, I don't prescribe. You said I could choose one, right? MDs in most states prescribe drugs, and I have a PhD. I didn't say schizophrenia doesn't exist. I mean, I did say it. I'm not questioning your reality. But I was quoting the guy who runs the National Institutes of Mental Health, who said it. And why did he say it? Because there's no single disease of schizophrenia. There are hallucinations and delusions and thought disorders and the other agitation and so on that go together. But there may be many, there are indeed many ways, many things that we would normally think of as diseases that result in that pattern. So there is no single thing as such single thing as schizophrenia. That's what I meant by that.
Okay. Yes. Richard.
What a great presentation. I think we can all agree on that. However, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. My background is I'm a diplomat of the Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, so I have some interest in both. And I have the idea that psychiatry is mainly all symptoms.
Psychiatry is what? I didn't
mainly hear. All symptoms. And neurology basically deals with diseases. But that's, having said that, it's not quite right, because in the beginning, neurology was all symptoms. And as we learned more, by dealing with clusters of symptoms, we found diseases. And when we saw those clusters and began to look at their brains or their biochemistry, we found out that they were disease and not just clusters of symptoms. So I wouldn't want people to go away from this discussion thinking that clusters of symptoms today might not be diseases tomorrow. I think that's an important, that's really an important thing. And the second thing is, I think that people who, so that the guys who got together and tried to create the DSM back in the early 50s, now we're in our fifth iteration, they had the idea that it would be good to classify groups of symptoms based on symptoms, and that might lead to something in the future. Well, it's turned out to be useful for finance and insurance companies and government and all that, but groups of symptoms right now have real potential benefit. So I wonder if you could, short question, you could agree with that, you probably can. And the second thing is, if you wouldn't think that maybe all the sort of the little things, if you look at what's been written recently about the DSM, everyone talks about the grief thing, about the Asperger's thing, they can find, but they don't talk about hundreds of things wrong with thousands of diagnoses, okay?
Yes, not just psychiatric diagnoses.
Yeah, so I think we're really talking about, when you classify, there are going to be gray areas, and those gray areas are really tough. But I don't think we should go away from that, saying we shouldn't classify.
Well, let me try to expand on that point just a little bit, because that's a really important point. So what really is happening, one of the things that's happening here is that we're hamstrung by a very specific definition of disease. We believe that a disease is a form of suffering that's caused by an identifiable biochemical pathogen. Now that, And the comment you made about neurology. So an example. There used to be a disease called tabes, or general paresis, and there used to be another disease that called syphilis that had genital sores as one of its major symptoms. And then there was yet another disease that consisted of bodily lesions. And when the syphilis spirochete was finally discovered at the end of the 19th century, it turned out these were all three the same disease. So what you have there is a perfect model of what you're talking about, clustering together a group of symptoms and finding the biochemical cause underneath. Well, I think it turns, and that, by the way, is the basis of many of the miracles of medicine. The idea that you can find the target and send in the drugs and kill it. The whole magic bullet model of medicine, which evolved in the 19th century And saved, I mean, strep throat used to kill kids as recently as 150 years ago. It totally changed our idea of what a disease is. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, there's this huge temptation to turn all of suffering into that kind of a problem. Because if you can do that, then theoretically, all our troubles will be fixable by doctors. And you can see this is one of the reasons that, you know, healthcare consumes whatever it consumes, 15% of the GDP, because we really want that to be true. But it isn't, or at least it hasn't proven to be so far. And one way to deal with this is to think of a disease in a different way. A disease is a form of suffering that we decide as a society to devote resources to relieving. Now, if you think about it that way, you realize that, yeah, all these diseases that are caused by spirochetes or whatever, we think, yeah, that's cool, spend a lot of money researching that. But there may be other bases for deciding to spend money on suffering. And at that point, it may be sufficient simply to stay with the symptom, simply to stay with the close observation of the way symptoms group together, which is what Hippocrates did. So I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but the idea to me of the baby in the bathwater is the thing that needs to be thrown away, or at least put to the side, is this idea that every kind of suffering is going to yield to this model.
There's almost no other choice than to look for solutions, okay? John Hospers, who was the head of philosophy at UCLA, said there's no causal law because we find lots of places where we don't find causes. So there are lots of symptoms where we don't have any causes. But what he says there said is there's a causal principle. Let's look for causes. It's worthwhile to look for causes because if we don't look, we're not going to find anything.
Yeah, but you see, look, causes don't have to be biochemical. That's all I'm trying to say. So, for instance, let's take a completely different example. Drunk driving is a transportation. It's a mass transit problem, right? If there was mass transit available all the time everywhere you wanted to go, and it's, but it's, you know, you can change the focus, the way that you approach a problem. How much of this problem of schizophrenia is the problem of homelessness and poverty? I don't know the answer to that question. But there are causes elsewhere besides in the body, and medicine focuses on what's inside the body.
Okay, that man there. Yes. There, right there, he's...
Following up on that last point, that causes exist outside of illness, the question is how much of mental illness in this country is actually caused by economic inequality, which is not remediable by treating it as an illness. Now, the answer to that, one answer to that would be, I wanted to ask if you could comment on that. Roger Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who wrote a book called The Spirit Level, two WHO, World Health Organization epidemiologists, crunch a very large amount of data and drew a graph that just stopped me in my tracks. And it showed the relationship between economic inequality among rich countries and the rate of mental illness. For example, we are the most unequal rich country. We are the champion there. And our rate of mental illness per year is 25% reported mental illness. And this is using WHO's criteria. The rate of mental illness in much more equal rich countries like Belgium and Japan is less than 10%.
Okay. What is your question?
My question is then you'd have to ask, in terms of in regard to the DSM, that it has a role in justifying extreme inequality because it diverts attention from that the fact that I just mentioned. Yes. Diverts attention from economic inequality.
This is your
inequality.
Paid plant, right?
Yes. Yeah, so
this is your paid plant, right?
Yes. Thank you. The DSM is only one very small part of that problem. But one of the things that happens that the DSM is a really good example of is the way you see what you look for and you look for what you know. And what drug company is going to fund the study showing the disconnection between inequality and mental illness? It's not going to happen. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of the money for research is coming from. When Obama declares another, whatever it was, brain initiative, which is the second brain initiative, by the way, the first one being the decade of the brain in 1990, and the NIMH decides to throw all of its weight behind this neuroscience-based idea, they're not going to be looking at it either. Increasingly, the trouble is going to have to be located within each of us and ultimately in our molecules, which to me is creepy.
We have time for two more quick questions. Yes, the woman back there in the corner.
I'm going to try to figure out how to word this. And if you're wondering who I am your cousin, Fran Gilmore. Long lost. And very much enjoyed your presentation.
How do you like that? It's family reunion.
Wow. Yeah. It's almost a Seder.
There's a reason to write books.
The question is about going back to maybe the first question about neuroplasticity, but from another point of view, which is meditation. And yogis and meditators have known for a long time, and now science sometimes tries to study what happens when people are deep meditators. And I don't know what happens, but I've heard the claim that actually changes take place in the brain and people get fixed, if you want. And I wonder if you would comment on that process.
Yeah, it's the same. I think that gets to the same point I was trying to make before. There's no doubt about it. Nothing that happens to you in your mental life doesn't happen in your brain. It's always a question of whether you've identified both the necessary and the sufficient condition, in this case, for the change observed through meditation. And the answer is nobody knows. Maybe nobody will ever know. We're not maybe going to figure this out. I had lunch once with a guy named Arvid Carlson, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine back in the early, for his work establishing the relationship between dopamine and Parkinson's disease, which was actually the work that established the notion of neurotransmission, chemical neurotransmission. And I put this question to him. And he said, I don't think we're ever going to figure this out. Now, this is a guy who spent his life doing it. He said, and by the way, he made an evolutionary argument. He said, what would be the evolutionary advantage of understanding that?
Okay. One last quick question. Okay. The woman right there. Yeah, we need a microphone. Hold on one sec.
Have you read Proof of Heaven by Alexander Eben?
I haven't read it, no. That was a quick question.
It's a really interesting book.
But I know of the book and I know of the argument that it makes. And there are a couple of books that go into this whole thing, this whole question about the possibility of consciousness without a brain. It's sort of an interesting... Do we have time for one more? One more? Yes, we have time for one
more. One more, okay.
This fellow in the blue shirt.
In the blue shirt, okay.
He's been patiently sitting there with his hand up.
Okay.
Yeah. Good evening, sir. Thank you very much for taking my question. Do you think that all the problems that we have in so many fields of knowledge, not just psychiatrists, it could be related to the philosophy that we call it existentialism in the 50s? Those great generations, they came out, they fought wars, they decided to become existentialists. They had that experience behind. They actually studied, they were raised as an idealist. So they have the right to become an existentialist. Now, the generation after them, they were raised from they were little children as existentialists.
Yes.
Do you think that existentialism is the problem that we have? We are not only raised people existentialists. We abandon idealism and we abandon religion.
Yeah, so let me just quickly answer that with a very parochial comment, which is that existentialism was an insignificant part of psychiatry until the DSM-3. And in fact, a lot of the blame for the crisis in psychiatry came to fixate on a group called the Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry, who weren't all existentialists, but they were people who saw the relationship of human beings to each other and to their natural and social world as crucial to understanding mental disorder. And they got a bad rap because the disorder in psychiatry was blamed on them. And this, we're now, you know, 40 years later, this is the result. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of existentialism. It's good stuff. So I think we're done, right?
Yes. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.